Welcome to the U.S. Law Essentials Law and Language Podcast, the legal English podcast for non-native English speakers that helps you improve your English listening, improve your legal English vocabulary, and build your knowledge of American legal culture.
Welcome to U.S. Law Essentials Law and Language Podcast. I'm your host, Stephen Horowitz. And before we get started, is there a topic, a case, something in the legal news you'd like to hear us talk about in a future episode, or perhaps a multilingual lawyer or cross-cultural law professional you think we should interview? You can let us know by emailing daniel@uslawessentials.com, or also by posting in the U.S. Law Essentials Facebook or LinkedIn group. We want to talk about what you want to hear, and if you're interested, there are likely many other people who are also interested in the same thing. Plus, we'll mention your name in the podcast. So please do connect with us. Today's episode continues our series of interviews with multilingual lawyers. And today's guest is Yi Song, a Chinese lawyer based in Washington, D.C., who works for a Beijing-based real estate development company. Yi is also a colleague of mine at Georgetown Law, where she is an adjunct professor of law and teaches a course on legal writing to LLM students. Additionally, she is a graduate of Georgetown Law's LLM program and completed her undergraduate studies at Beijing Foreign Studies University. And on top of that, she is also a fan of this podcast and told me she never imagined she would actually hear her own voice on here. Is that right?
Yes, exactly.
Welcome, Yi. It's so nice to finally have you as a guest.
Thank you so much, Stephen, for having me.
I also want to note that I had not realized you are a Kim Kardashian superfan, which I know because you sent me a link yesterday to her recent Twitter post in which she announced that she had finally passed the baby bar in California. And we had done an episode about Kim Kardashian and passing the bar exam early on in this podcast series. So thank you so much for that.
Thank you. Or thank you for mentioning it. I don't know if I will call myself a Kim Kardashian super fan, but she did came up on my Twitter like 4 minutes after she tweeted that. And I'm happy for her on the fourth attempt to pass the baby bar in California. So congrats, yeah. Kim.
Yeah, it sounds like a real challenge. So she did it. Okay, so let me ask you, what bars have you passed in the U.S.? And did you celebrate like Kim Kardashian did?
I passed New York bar in 2010. And since I also practice in Seattle, Washington, so I'm licensed to practice in Washington State. So I have the bar in New York and in Washington State. Oh. And I didn't celebrate as Kim because back then there wasn't Twitter.
Right. A little harder to celebrate so publicly. Did you take the New York bar and the Washington State bar at the same time, like the same year?
I took the New York bar after I graduated from Georgetown Law. I have a practice in New York for about 5 years. So when I moved to Seattle, I waved into the Washington bar, but there's still like a mini exam you need to take before you are officially admitted. And it is a really long, winding process. They like conducted their due diligence and look into my background in China, reach out to my law school in China, you know, talk to my employer back in China. So it's pretty intense process.
Wow. Okay. And let's see. And you mentioned to me that you enjoy listening to this podcast. So I figured I should ask you, what do you like about it? Or is there something about it that you find helpful?
Yes, I love your podcast. I think it's great that it shed light on the stories of multilingual lawyers. We're not a very visible group in the law, I would say. But of course, with services that your podcast provided, there's more and more that you hear about us. But it's just interesting to hear what our multilingual lawyers are up to, what is their legal practice is like. We don't have a lot of representations in the legal industry, except for, I guess, Amal Clooney, who has a Bachelor of Law degree and who is practicing, who is very visible in the public realm. Other than her, I guess we will be hearing more and more of us from your podcast.
Yeah, yeah. Hopefully this starts a trend and there's more representation. And also, now that you're here, is there anyone out there that you want to say hello to?
Oh, man, so many. A shout out to everybody from the Legal English Center at Georgetown Law.
All right. Okay. Well, it's so nice to have you here. And then now that you're famous on the podcast, how do you plan to handle all the pressures of your new... what if Kim Kardashian starts following you on your Twitter feed?
I know. I'm waiting for that day. I'm sitting on my hand waiting for that day. So hit me on Twitter, Kim.
All right. You got that, Kim, if you're listening. Okay. So now let me get back to some of the other questions I wanted to ask you. What countries have you lived in your life?
So I'm from China. I was born and raised in Beijing, China. Spent 2/3 of my life in China, and I moved to the United States in my early 20s for law school. So primarily lived in China and the U.S. and visited other places in Asia, Europe. And I do have a relative in Japan, so I visited her as a child in the summer.
Oh, interesting. So you've sort of been all over. In one way, you know, in different ways. And what languages do you speak, or what languages have you studied in your life?
My native language is Mandarin Chinese, and I have studied in Hong Kong. So at one point I speak and understand Cantonese, which is very different from Mandarin Chinese. Mm-hmm. And I have learned a little bit Japanese, but didn't get that far. And I have learned French. I've studied French when I was in New York at Alliance Française. So,
how is your French now?
Not good. Not good. I did not make my teachers proud.
And let me ask you a question now. So you now seem pretty fluent in English. If you are asked to do a math problem in English, or if you're asked to do a math problem, can you do it in your head in English, or does your mind go back to Mandarin?
Interesting. I'm not good at math to begin with, so I'm not excited to do a math problem in any language.
If I say what's 4 + 5?
That's nice.
You can do that in English. Okay.
I guess I'll do it in English. Yeah.
What if I said, what is 32 minus 12?
That's 20. Is it 20? 20.
Yeah.
I guess English.
Oh, wow. That's really great. As I always think about, like, you know, you really sort of get command of a language when you have dreams in that language.
Exactly.
But I had a dream in Japanese when I lived in Japan, but then I realized at another point that if you do math in that language in your head, then that's like a real, I think that's a real sign of sort of full fluency. So that's why I was thinking about that. Mm. So when you were growing up in China, did you speak English?
Well, I learned English as all school children do in China. We started in elementary school just to learn English as a child, and they teach British English. I think that, at least to me, they're trying to speak British. But I really started to learn when I was a teenager, just being exposed to American pop culture, listening to songs and watching American movies.
So you sort of got into the language not just through school studies, but through a genuine interest.
Yeah, I kind of learned the language organically because school is like all about memorizing vocabularies and study grammar. It's boring, for a kid. But if you develop your own interest to follow this role model sort of and have a crush on this person, the singer, the celebrity, it's much a greater motivation to learn.
So when you came over to do your LLM degree at Georgetown, what was your level of English at that point? How would you describe it?
I guess at that point, I would say I had been learning for 20 years or so, and I was a lawyer in China, and I always been learning, you know, go to after school program to study English and talk to other native speakers. So it's, yeah, probably just like any language learner who has been learning and speaking the language for 20 years.
And then do you feel like since you came over to do your LLM degree, has your English improved? Or I'm guessing your English has improved a lot in doing the degree, and then you've been working here and living here in the US. And if I'm wrong, if you think your English has gotten worse, you can tell me that. What if anything has helped you improve your English through this period since you arrived in the US?
I certainly hope that it didn't get worse. I hope just being fully immersed in the language, you know, in all aspects of the linguistic acquisition, writing, listening, speaking, reading, and all of that, not just about the materials that you are exposed to in law school, but non-law books and materials help me a lot.
And then if it's okay, I want to ask you a little bit about your LLM experience.
Of course.
What about it was helpful, or what things do you think you did right in your LLM experience? And what, if anything, do you think you might have done a little bit differently?
I think the primary interest for me is to learn English, to improve my English, which still today give me adrenaline rush if I know that my English is improving. So I kind of gravitate towards the language learning part of the experience when I was here for the degree. You know, that back then the legal English program is just in his infancy, but our you know, Professor Hoffman was there. So I spent a lot of time at his office hour just asking, how do I improve my English? Not so much about law. I feel like that learning the language and being a language learner is just who I am. And just law, practicing law is what I do. So about the experience itself, just being generally exposed to American life in law school and outside law school, have the complete American experience is very refreshing, because before I arrived in the US, I also watched a lot of TVs and movies about the US, and a lot of them are not exactly, a lot of them are misconstrued about the law.
Really?
I remember I watched, like coming of age around the 2000, I watched Ally McBeal.
Oh, yeah.
Like a lot of TV lawyers and Legally Blonde, Elle Woods, Legally Blonde.
And how did that compare to your experience at Georgetown Law School?
Nobody has that much time. No lawyers or law student has that much time spent on social life, of course. I was like, if my life in law school was in a movie, it's going to be me sitting behind a desk at all time. A very long shot of that.
Yes. And then is there anything you might have done differently in your LLM career?
I would say I would probably be less stressed out about everything, just more relaxed, and try to interact more with my peers, because I was very stressed out about finals and exams and the bar exam and looking for jobs. Didn't spend a lot of time socializing. I remember they have a social calendar, a decent one, although there's not a lot on it, but one of them is called Bar Review. And I was so stressed out about the bar exam. I thought, oh, I need to sign up on it. Everything about the bar, I need to be there. And as it turned out, it is literally a review of bars near law school, like every single bar in the city, they would go to bars and review the bars.
That's what we had that in when I was in law school. I think it was called Bar Review. It was Thursday nights, and it was getting together at a bar.
Yeah.
So, and did you go? And did you enjoy it?
I went for the first gathering and immediately realized that was not the bar review I was after.
That sounds like great advice for future LLM students. Be careful of the term bar review. There's some wordplay going on there.
Yeah.
And now you've been practicing as a lawyer in the U.S. for a while. Tell us about your legal practice now.
Yes, I'm an in-house counsel for a real estate company, and the company is headquartered in Beijing and publicly listed in Hong Kong. So I work on a lot of cross-border transactions. I manage the legal and risk aspect of the business operation in the United States, deal with just the usual operation of a real estate company, acquisition, financing, construction, development, purchase, and sales. And other things, like since our source of funds are from overseas, so there's a lot of work on international taxations, offshore funds, structuring, you know, work with other tax haven lawyers like Haven and BVI. Our company is based in Hong Kong, so there's a lot of securities compliance work in Hong Kong.
And it's interesting, as you're talking about your practice, like how many different areas of law you have a finger in your role as in-house counsel.
Yeah, it is great fun. It's just like running a general practice. It's basically whatever the company has encountered legally, I'm part of that.
And how did you end up in this role with this company? How did you find this job?
Interesting story. So I worked in New York in the corporate security side. At the time, there's a program called EB-5, Immigrant Investors Program. So we raise capital for U.S.-based entities overseas. And that program was predominantly investors from China. So my background was useful to the firm. And EB-5 program was really in its heydays at the time that I was practicing. And after 5 years in New York, I was basically burned out. It's very long hours. And I moved to the Pacific Northwest with my husband. And I was just looking for jobs, you know, trying to look into all the big tech companies. And one day I got a message from LinkedIn saying that we have this position opening, are you interested in, it's connected to your background and your practice. And it just sounds very sketchy. And it's on LinkedIn, you know, you got tons of message on LinkedIn every day. And I was thinking it must be a scam. But I just reached out to the person and started talking, and they set up interviews. And, you know, as it turned out, it is not a scam. And that's how I got my job. Yeah, they found me.
What made you feel like it might be a scam? What types of things, what types of concrete things were you getting a vibe from?
Because at the time, I got, other than that message, I also received like 10 other messages on LinkedIn, which I don't, you know, reach out, or I don't call back. It just looks like either, you know, sales, or you don't know what they're about.
Uh-huh. So it's more because there's a lot of other messages. Why would this one be any different?
I know. Yeah.
And LinkedIn. So that's really great. LinkedIn is a really terrific resource. And we can put your LinkedIn profile in the show notes if it's okay for people to connect with you.
Of course. Thank you.
So, and now what do you like about your work as a lawyer?
I like it because it just exposed me to great legal drama and great legal stories. I always gravitate towards a certain narrative. in life. So I guess law is a dispute, and every legal dispute is a short story, right? And people, you encounter people in these situations where the emotions is very heightened. If it is litigation, it's very confrontational, and people are literally upset. There's cannot be a win-win. You know, there's got to be a winner and a loser. And but if it's transactional, it's a zero-sum game. You know, if you're making more money, I'm making less, and why? So people are fighting about it, and the stake is high. So I like to go in there and observe how people would respond in these situations. Is it because their personal history, their background, or their cultural references? I just think it's overall very interesting.
Oh, wow. So you really, so it's a place, it's a position from which you can observe a lot about human nature and the stories.
Absolutely.
That's interesting. I always like to avoid the conflicts. Maybe that's why I stopped practicing law a long time ago. I'm like, can we all just work together? I'm happy with that. But it takes a certain skill to be able to go into other people's conflicts and keep your own cool, keep your head and keep everything calm.
Yeah, absolutely. I have friends who also feel that way, because within my class, I run a speaker series, and I talk to lawyers who is no longer practicing law. And to them, especially if they're in litigation, you know, it's very, very intense. It's very confrontational. And at many points, it can get very personal. It becomes personal attack on the counsels or on the clients. But to me, I guess it's helpful for me to step back, you know, as an observer. So I hope to observe these stories and write them down one day in some form.
Yeah, lawyers do get access to great stories of life.
Yeah, absolutely.
Now, speaking of stories, what are some of the challenges that you faced as a multilingual lawyer in the U.S. or in China?
Great questions. I think there are several aspects of that. The first thing is probably just identity. There's simply not enough of us practicing in the U.S., which is why I think your podcast is great. It really shed lights on this multilingual lawyers community. So going into meetings very often, you know, especially in the initial meetings where people, you know, just start to work together, that they will be like, oh, you have a legal background. What will your role be in this transaction? So they don't know where to place you. Like you're a lawyer. You're you know part of the business group. And other challenging aspects, including the legal culture, is very different. So I have one client now, which is the company, and in the beginning, there's quite a steep learning curve for myself and also for the company start doing business here in the United States. One constant complaint I got in early days is that, oh, why is this contract so long? Why is it 300 pages? You need to cut it down to 10 pages. Or why there are so many lawyers? You know, there's why do we have like six lawyers just to just complete this transaction? You're a lawyer. You're supposed to do everything. And another aspect, of course, the linguistic aspect. So there's a lot of the work about cross-border transactions with multilingual legal discourse is translation, but not literally as translating people's words in another language. There's also a legal context to that translation. A recent example I encountered is that the words affiliate and subsidiaries, it has specific meanings in US. Like affiliates means basically every company that are in the organizational chart, right? It can be directly owned, indirectly owned, or you have common shareholders. It basically covers every entities within your group. A subsidiary, it could be, you know, directly owned, indirectly owned. But in other jurisdictions, it necessarily means that. So we are in a situation where It got very intense. You know, we were trying to explain to the US-based investor what is going on with Chinese real estate.
Yeah.
There's just very drastic changes happening now. And if there's a point that the word is mistranslated, not a lot of people realize that it could lead to very significant consequences. Because if the investor is asking, are these affiliates has any liability problems? If you think the affiliates only means that the subsidiaries that you have 100% control, then you can give a very specific answer. But they're actually asking every single company within your organizational chart. So if you say something that, because based on your understanding of the different meaning of the term, it could mean that you are giving false statement or misleading statement to the investors. You could get into great trouble. And it's challenging because none of these are taught in law school or even in practice. You know, people don't realize these until you encounter the problem that right in there in the meeting.
Yeah, there's no course to teach you about this. You just have to figure it out when you get to it.
No, yeah. And another thing is just the line is always not always clear to me for my role, right? So as in-house counsel, we basically run a general practice within a company. If there's practice areas that I'm not 100% comfortable where I need a second opinion, I would just get a outside counsel. Mm-hmm. And so that means that in meetings, if I'm present with the CEO or the CFO or people on the business side. And I will do the translation, of course, so they can communicate with the US-based developers and investors. But sometimes I will just say that I will speak in my capacity as his interpreter, not as counsel. But that is not always clear, right? Because sometimes if I'm speaking on a subject that I'm familiar with, I am giving advice, I am speaking as counsel. So the line is sometimes blurry.
Right. You're wearing two different hats and you can get confused as to your own identity, or it can be confusing for the people that you're interacting with too.
Very much so.
Yeah,
very much so.
That is tricky, but great experience to be having and a great way to see the stories as well.
Yeah. Speaking of stories, there's also like humor in these contexts, not necessarily translate. So for American partners and, developers, they're very relaxed. No matter how high the stakes are, there's always an icebreaker and they open with a joke. If it is in-person meeting, I've seen this a million times, like delegate, the people from the Chinese side, they would just, no one laugh, or they would just stare at them with a poker face. And it just seems very awkward.
What do you recommend? Should American lawyers avoid, or American clients or companies avoid a joke as an icebreaker? Is there a better kind of icebreaker to do?
I don't know. I think just be you. That if they're exposed to these, they've been exposed to these situations a lot, so they understand. They understand the culture. Uh-huh. And just this happened recently. It's a very intense negotiation and things are at the verge of collapse. But at the end, I guess everybody was on the same page again. So it's all great. And the CEO on the other side just says that, well, if we succeed, this project is going to be a doozy. And I was immediately put on the spot because everybody is staring at me. And the person from the Chinese side just said, counsel, please translate. And I had no idea what doozy means in this context, or just the word.
Great word, yeah.
Or just the word by itself. I've been studying English for 30 years and no one has ever used that expression with me before. so I just made something up.
Situation. I'm trying to think. Do you remember how you translated it?
I translated into like, is they're going to have a big party. Everybody's going to get drunk. and because I kind of know that the CEO is a person who likes to have fun and he likes to joke about these things. And then I was later told that there will be no alcohol involved.
Oh wow! So you had to sort of, you had to improv a little bit. You had to sort of make it up as you go along.
Yeah,
that's great. Now let me ask you about another aspect of being a multilingual lawyer. You have in China, you speak Chinese, and that's what you grew up with. And here you speak fluent English, but you have an accent. You have a little bit of an accent when you speak Chinese. Has that been an issue at all for you? Because the way that Americans or native English speakers might perceive a lawyer with an accent, does that ever come up?
I guess that, you know, comes up in the identity questions, and it comes up in my practice. When I'm interacting with US-based lawyers, sometimes they will just, because they don't know where to place you, they don't know what your role is. And as I said earlier, sometimes the role can get very confusing, you know, the line. So I don't blame them for not being able to place me anywhere. So I have things that happen to me, such as, you know, we will review documents and we will review contract and we will offer red lines, right? It's just a part of the negotiation, basically like negotiating in writing. But I had lawyers who sent me just a first draft of their documents in PDF. And I found that slightly offensive. Like, in what way do you think we're going to agree 100% to what you offer us here? You know, we will have to negotiate. We will redline. And of course, I asked for a Word doc because that's what you will usually do to a lawyer, knowing that everything will get redlined, right? So that has happened. And the other situations, like when I was practicing in New York, we travel to China a lot because a lot of our investors are Chinese-based. And in one meeting, the partner was like, you should speak Chinese to the investors because that's your background and they will feel more connected to you. And I speak Chinese to the investors, but the investors were like, oh, we want a real American lawyer. You're not American lawyer because you're Chinese lawyer. And then in the next meeting we learned, right? And the partner is like, okay, now you speak English. And we'll just offer them whatever advice American lawyer would offer them. And I did, I speak English. And the investor were like, oh, how long have you been living in the United States? Now you don't speak Chinese anymore? And they think I'm so pretentious for not speaking Chinese. So you really learned along the way. So in the next meeting, I made a point that I would speak a little bit both.
Oh, that's a nice solution. Wow. But that's so tricky because you don't know how, you know, you go one way and that's wrong. And you go the other way and that seems wrong too. So it's a really tricky surface to navigate.
Indeed.
So let me ask you one last question. Is there any advice that someone has given you in life or in your legal career that you've appreciated, or advice that you like to give to other young lawyers or young international or multilingual lawyers?
I think it's like finding your way doesn't mean that you always know where you're going. It's, as young lawyers or law students, we have a very focused view on what we are going to grow up to be. Like, I want to be a tax lawyer. I want to do international arbitration, or I want to practice public international law. But I would say just you need to think about your interests more broadly. Like for me, I want to speak English. I want to keep improving my English. And I gravitate towards stories. So any career that will open me up to those opportunities, I'm 100% it's going to pursue it. And there's also a lot of like external criteria for young lawyers to be subject to. Like, if you get into big law or earning a big salary, living in a big city, that's one measurement of success. But you really got to ask yourself, is that what you want? This, you know, external assessment or criteria is not necessarily for everyone.
Oh, thank you. That's really good perspective. I wish I had some of that perspective when I was graduating from school. Yi, thank you so much. This has been a real doozy of an episode, which does not mean that we're going to have a party and get drunk. But it has been a really terrific, wonderful episode. And thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you so much, Stephen. It's very fun.
Okay, we will include any relevant links from this episode in the show notes. I want to remind our listeners to subscribe to the U.S. Law Essentials podcast on Apple, Stitcher, Spotify, Himalaya, or wherever you get your podcasts. And you can also listen to all episodes on uslawessentials.com. If you have any questions, comments, reactions, ideas, or anything else, we always love hearing from our listeners. You can contact us by email at daniel@uslawessentials.com or through the U.S. Law Essentials Facebook group or LinkedIn group. Thanks for listening to U.S. Law Essentials Law and Language Podcast, and stay essential.